So with that, I would like to take a moment to introduce John Soper, who is going to moderate the meeting tonight. I met John about 10 years ago. He and I have worked together off and on many years back. And again, like I said before, when we started talking about this, we were figuring out how to make something around the whole open source fit the marketing SIG. John started an organization called New Paradigms Marketing, where alliance management and open source are two of the things that he does, as well as what you would call general marketing and business strategy, contract negotiations, and alliance development and management. So with that, why don't I turn the meeting over to John. John will moderate, and we'll have panel discussion and then Q&A at the end. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ed, and thanks to SDF Forum for having us here, for all of you coming, and to our great panel. So I'm looking forward to this. I'm excited. I've been to been involved with open source for some time, but I still have a lot to learn, particularly as we move from kind of the infrastructure layer up into the application layer, and we're starting to see things work in new and interesting ways. And I and hopefully all of you will want to understand how this can work, what the issues are in making open source work in a real-life business development market approach. So that's what the focus is tonight. I've been to a lot of panels where we talk about open source in fairly generic terms, so we'll get a little more focused on the business strategies tonight. We have a great panel that has some perspectives in a number of different ways, but they've all got a lot of depth on open source. To my left is Bill Soward, and he is president and CEO of Adaptive Planning, an open source company, who will have a lot of interesting things to say. He's also a SaaS company, software as a service, and we're particularly interested in seeing how those things play together. Prior to that, he was an executive in executive at residence at Accel Partners, and a general manager of FRS, business unit of SI Corporation. He was also CEO of SI's Europe and S1 Europe and S1's Edify business unit. And prior to that, he held several executive positions at Edify and actually helped drive the acquisition of Edify by S1. Prior to that, he also held a number of management roles with Siemens Roles and IBM, and has a BS degree in business administration from UC Berkeley. I will let, when we get to his part of the program a little more, I'll ask him to drill down a little bit on his company and what they're doing in the open source world. To his left is John Barra, who was a vice president of marketing at ZenSource. Prior to that, he was the VP, a senior VP of marketing at Interwoven. Prior to that, he was the vice president of marketing at Genesis Tech Telecommunications Labs. He was also with Intel and was in the management team for the Pentium Group, a financial controller, and you've got a long list of things you did at Intel here.
A lot of fun stuff.
Also a former banking executive with the Bank of Boston and Citibank Tokyo. So a broad education, a broad background and an education, being from Oberlin, which is just down the street from my Ohio Wesleyan, and an MBA from Harvard Business School. Also very lucky to have with us Bernard Golden, who's the founder and CEO of Navica, which is an open source consultancy. So Bernard has made a business out of being an expert in open source, and as a matter of fact, Bernard has not paid me to do this, but he's got a book, which I'm sure you'll be signing afterwards, Succeeding with Open Source. So he's done a lot of speaking, authoring, he's got a blog and CIO online, and a lot of consulting, these two being clients, is that correct? And numerous other open source companies as clients. So we have some real drill down depth and some breadth to add to the panel with Bernard. Prior to that, he was a venture partner for international venture funds, And prior to that, he was vice president and general manager of a number of software companies, including Informix, Uniplex Software, and Deploy Solutions. So, kind of the way I'd like to approach this tonight is to drill down on three business areas, business case study areas. One being marketing and the open source model and how businesses are utilizing that to leverage their marketing efforts. Second, open source software and that model and how it interplays with the community development model. There are a number of ways that can be done, and pluses and minuses to different ones. So we'll hear some good perspectives on that. And the third area we'd like to drill down on is how open source companies play in third-party alliances, anyway, from joint marketing to OEMs to acquisitions, such as many of you probably read about the Citrix acquisition of Zensource, which we're going to hold that till last. How do you make $500 million on an acquisition from an open source company? We're going to hear a lot about that in the end, I hope. So, those are the kinds of things we'd like to drill down on. But to get us all on, since this is probably somewhat new, a little bit differently for different people, I'd like to get us all on the same page. And Bernard has kindly offered to give us a bit of an overview of where open source is today and what some of the challenges are and what some of the leverage points are. And if I can...
Is the microphone working?
After all the feedback, I'm afraid to try it. Is this on?
Is it on?
It's on.
Okay. So, how many people here work at companies that open source is a significant part of their strategy? And how many people are at companies that are starting to think about using open source as part of their strategy? And how many people came just because they were serving pizza? All right. Well, we're going to talk tonight about open source software, the new software paradigm, and kind of what is interesting about open source, what's driving it, you know, what the interesting challenge points are for it, and so forth. And of course, the first thing we're going to start with is the fount of all knowledge technical, Dilbert. Can everybody in the back read this? Okay, well, guys, this is great eye chart stuff. All right, so essentially, the pin-headed boss has found out about open source and says, I want you to use open source for everything because it's free. And then they essentially have to rein him in, of course, as they do with everything. Really, beyond the fact that Dilbert's a fun cartoon and so forth, what this really strikes me is open source has hit the mainstream. If Dilbert's making fun of it to an audience that's pretty mainstream, open source is getting there. So, with that, let's start off and talk about open source. Well, what is open source software? And the reason the elephant's up there is, it's sort of, I hearken back to this fable, I guess it is, where six blind Indian men were brought to an elephant and asked, please describe it. One grabbed the tail and said, oh, it's thick and long. It's an elephant is like a rope. And another one said, felt its legs and said, oh, they're huge and strong. This must be like a big tree. And another one felt the ears and said, oh, this is wavy and flappy. It must be some kind of like a bat. And then one felt the tusk and said, oh, it's sharp and long and pointed. It must be like a spear. And the point of that is that open source has a lot of different opinions about what it's about. And many people look at things and say, this is what it is. But it's really an agglomeration of a number of things. And these are the kinds of things that I draw out. One is, it's a collaborative development methodology. It's a way for people to work together to develop products. And those can be individuals, or they can also be companies collaborating. And we'll be talking, I think both of our case studies, and particularly Zensource, will be talking about how that's interesting, how competitors can work together to create a product that they both take advantage of for their own competitive pursuits. And the benefits of that and also the challenges. But it is a way for people to work together, in contrast to the old way that things were done, which is basically you hired a lot of smart people, you put them in an office in Palo Alto, and they built something kind of on their own. This is much more of a worldwide phenomenon that anybody can contribute to. From the perspective of a lot of software companies, it's an inexpensive way to achieve distribution. You put it out there and anybody can download it and begin using it. You don't have to go tell them about it, you don't have to convince them of it. They find their way to it, they pull it down, they start using it. So instead of having to go out one by one and find people to use your product, you can really let the internet distribute your product for you and let people start talking about it. So it's a great way to achieve distribution at a lower price. It is, of course, a threat to proprietary software companies, although many of them still will say, oh no, we don't really see open source as their competitor, or you know, it's used by small companies, blah, 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 blah. It's a competitive threat, and I think that that's becoming more and more clear as time goes on. It is, of course, a licensing regimen. Open source is driven by the licenses that carry it, and I'll be talking about that in a couple of slides, but essentially what makes open source is the license that the software carries. And in contrast to traditional proprietary licenses that are typically kind of custom done almost for every deal, where it's kind of, we're going to give you this much usage, this many machines, this many users, open source licenses are more or less attached to the software and say, you know, it's a standard license, this is the conditions you can use it under, and so forth. And the licenses really discipline the way the software can be used. In particular, open source licenses give you a lot more freedom as a perspective of a user. You can use it pretty much any way you want to use it. You can put it on as many machines as you want. You can even modify the product because the source code is included. And that's a factor of all these open source licenses. I'll talk about this a little bit more in terms of the business implications of it for a vendor.
Let me try clicking this on and see if that's better.
Everybody still here? Okay. And then, according to some people, it is the only software solution on the planet. There are ideologues associated with open source or free software that essentially say this is the only way that software should be. I mean, there are people within the movement who sort of say intellectual property is theft. And so you will run into that as well. That's an interesting perspective. But it's all of those things. And really, as you agglomerate all those things, what it is it's a huge change to the software industry as we know it, a huge change to the IT industry as we know it. IDC, which is a large analyst firm, described it as open source as being the biggest change to the software industry in 25 years. So it's a huge, huge, you know, sea change. All right, let's go to the next slide. So why are companies turning to open source? Well, from the vendor perspective, there's the exhaustion of the enterprise business model. It used to be you put those smart people in Palo Alto, they build a product, you get it to 1.0, and then you hire a big, expensive direct sales force to go bang down doors, get you customers. And what's really happened over the last 8 to 10 years is that model's become exhausted. The buyers stopped buying that way. They got tired of it. They got tired of having salespeople come and maybe characterize their product as being more capable than it was. And what happened was, from the perspective of the vendors, and also from the vendors, the funders, was it just got too expensive to build those kind of companies. You had to pour too much money into them for what you get. And so that model has really gotten very troubled and very exhausted. For the existing companies on that model, like Oracle or whatever, it's still a pretty good deal. But in terms of a startup, it's very difficult to try and move forward with that. So, you know, we need to find something different as a vendor, open source. A lot of the reason that companies look to it is time to market and component cost advantages. If you don't have to build something, if you don't have to write it yourself, if you don't have to pay the expense of getting it developed, but you can leverage open source that's already out there, you can bring your own product to market a lot more quickly. And also, you can keep more margin than you would have had in the past. So in the past, if you had to license a component, and I'll just use one as an example, if you needed an application server and you bought BEA, you'd be giving up some of your margin to BEA. And given that the market's gotten tougher, people started saying, I don't want to give up that much margin. And so they turned to open source components as a way of saying, I can use software but not have to give up margin. That makes it better for me. And really, to reiterate the point that I was talking about in the last slide, the ability to achieve distribution and adoption with different time cost constraints. I mean, you can reach people with your product that you never would have been able to reach before. You can get to them much earlier than you would have been able to before. You can get different geographies that maybe you wouldn't have gotten to for 3 or 5 years. Those people can find your product, begin using it, like it a lot, and call you up and say, I want to get enter your business relationship. Whereas if you'd started under the old model, you never would have gotten your product to them, and they never would have been able to enter into financial transactions. So it's very attractive from that perspective. From the perspective of users, which is the flip side, why are they interested in open source? Why are they willing to use open source? Why are they interested in open source companies? Well, first and foremost, probably cost. Essentially, it costs a lot less to get going with open source. There isn't a big license fee up front. And that's very, very attractive. It also gives them the lack of lock-in, you know, because there's no bit coercion. In other words, you have to give me a lot of money to get access to the bits, to get access to the product. And once you've done that, you're locked to me, because I'm the only company you can get the product from, updates from, support from. Open source works on a very different model. The product's put out there. You don't have to pay for that. You can either come to the company for support or not if you don't want to. And if the company doesn't do a good job, you're not locked in. You can walk away. You can find someone else to support you. So lack of lock-in is a big reason. Opportunity for customization. I was talking to a pharmaceutical company. I was talking about this with somebody just a little earlier. Bioinformatics company. And they had a real challenge in that they're big companies, but bioinformatics isn't that large a market. And so the vendors who sell software into that market typically don't have great products because they don't make enough to really invest enough to keep it up to date, put in new functionality. So they're very frustrated as users. So they came to me and said, what we'd like to do is maybe put together a consortium of bioinformatics using companies to build our own products because we feel that we can take open source components, customize them, and get a better solution for us. So the opportunity to take that source code and do things with it, very attractive. And then a collaboration with the community. You know, open source is sort of inherently associated with the community, the other people who are using it, and maybe people who are developing it. You know, it's a fount of wisdom. It's a great way to get information. It's a great way to co-develop. And as an end user, the ability to turn to other people and say, gosh, I'm running into this problem with this product, and have them say, oh, I had that problem too. Here's how you go solve it, is just a great, it's a great resource. I mean, I'll never forget, the first time I built an open source-based system, our group was working on one piece and another group was working with a proprietary product. We ran into problems and we post something to a mailing list. 20 minutes later, we're getting answers from all over the world. Here's how you do it, I did it, here's some code I did, so forth. The people using the proprietary part of the proprietary product for their part of the project called up the support group and basically got somebody who knew less about the product than they did. That's a huge difference, so the opportunity to collaborate with the community is great. It's a great thing. So these are kind of what's driving people to begin looking at open source. In terms of building a business strategy around it, what do you have to do? Let's go on to the next slide. Well, one of the things you have to do is ensure that open source use is managed properly. And this is true whether you're creating an open source product from scratch that you're delivering, like a ZenSource or an adaptive planning, or if you're incorporating open source components within your own product. You have to be very certain about the license that you're using. Because remember, those licenses I talked about come with certain kinds of conditions. And you have to abide by them all. And if you don't, typically you're not going to get sued, but someone's going to come to you and say, you know, you really need to comply with these license requirements. You either need to change your product to come into compliance with it, or you need to remove it. And so this is a really big deal. And so being in compliance with the license is really important. And it's also important because there's kind of a, you know, a movement around open source, and you want to rely on the goodwill of that movement. And if you're seen as not compliant with the licenses, you're going to have problems with your business strategy trying to appeal to those folks. You have to make sure that your business model aligns with the licenses. If the license calls for the product to be available a certain way, or that something can be done with the product, and your business model doesn't align with that, you're going to be in real conflict. You can use open source to get great distribution, to piggyback on it, but if you're not aligned with the license, you're always going to be at cross purposes and have a really difficult time with your business strategy, not to mention difficulty with your community that's built up around it. And I should say that being open source is not enough to guarantee success. I've seen a lot of companies that sort of said, oh, our product's not doing so well, we'll make it open source, and that'll solve everything. I kind of call that the Tom Sawyer strategy. You know, it's kind of like, would all of you out there mind coming over and painting my fence? Would you mind taking care of my product that I don't want to deal with? You've got to have, open source is not enough to make the product successful. You have to do all the things surrounding open source to make it successful. We'll talk about that in just a minute here. You have to ensure that your business model aligns with open source realities. The first and foremost is, can you build a community? That is absolutely fundamentally crucial to open source products being successful. Can you build a pool of people who are using it, who are involved with it, who are willing to interact with you, who are willing to contribute to it, who are willing to work with other members of the community? Are you willing to be transparent? This is a real challenge for many, many companies, particularly companies that say, I'm now proprietary, I want to go open source. First and foremost, your code's transparent. There's nowhere to hide. You can't put out kind of junky products and hope that nobody will really know, because everybody can read the code. So your engineering group has to become less egotistical, or maybe less defensive about their code, because people are going to look at it and comment on it. I was working with one company that created an open source product for their own hardware product, right? So they had their own hardware product. They wrote code to go with it. They turned the code into the open source, the main open source project. And the person there started to comment back to them and said, oh, I've rewritten your code, so it's better. So, I mean, you can see what kinds of transparency go on. But beyond just the code itself, which is clear from the license, there's an expectation that you're going to be more open about things like your product plans. You're going to be more willing to engage with people about product plans. The old model of, hey, we're showing up, here's our slide deck, we're going to tell you what the world's going to look like, you know, this is sort of the dog food you need to be ready to eat, that doesn't work in this kind of a world. And so you've got to be a lot more transparent, a lot more willing to engage. And then finally, of course, your product has to make sense as open source. In other words, it has to be something that people want to adopt, download, use, experiment with, and contribute. And there are certain products that make a ton of sense that way, and certain ones that don't. An area that open source hasn't done a lot in yet is vertical applications. Those don't seem to have really caught fire. We've seen applications go open source, like CRM and stuff like that. That seems like it maybe gets some traction. And of course, infrastructure makes a ton of sense as open source. So you've got to have the right business to wrap around open source. Otherwise, it's not going to generate the kind of energy distribution and so forth that you need. With that, I think that's it.
Thank you very much, Bernard. That's very useful, and we will now start to put some flesh on the bones, if you will. First, I want to give John and Bill a chance to give just a little bit of overview of the company so we understand and how open source makes sense with them, so that we can get some context. Do you have a...
Right. Let me just give a quick overview. Adaptive planning, we are in the business performance management category. And that, in this context, is budgeting, planning, financial reporting, dashboards, operational metrics. If you know Hyperion, a company that was bought several months ago by Oracle for over $3 billion, Hyperion is in that same market, but for enterprise customers. We are focused on the mid-market. None of these are my slides, so I'm just talking. So we target companies with 100 employees up to 2,000 employees is our focus. Founded in 2003, first customer in production at the end of 2004. Today we have about 125 customers. We are a software as a service company. And so initially our first rollout of our product was as a hosted offering, so a traditional software as a service model. But as you look at the category that we're in, particularly the mid-market and lower enterprise customers, there's a huge amount of data involved in trying to make those applications work well, and so there is more of a bias in that space for in favor of on-premise-based alternatives, so it's not just about hosting. And so we made a decision back in the spring of 2006 that we would offer an on-premise version of our product in order to maximize our appeal in the marketplace. And I would say that, you know, in software service land, the number one marquee company is Salesforce.com, and it's about getting thousands of customers. They have 30,000 customers. You know, our challenge as a business was how do we build a business quickly that has thousands of customers generating tens of millions of dollars and do that in a very capital efficient way. Salesforce raised $65 million or something at the bubble. NetSuite, another famous software as a service company, had over $100 million of Larry Ellison's money. You know, we didn't have access to all that cash, and so our challenge was how to get big fast and not spend a lot of money getting from here to there or a lot of time. And so as we looked at it, okay, part one, need an on-premise solution. Part two, if you're going to introduce an on-premise solution and it's 2006, what's the absolute best way to do that? There's no question that leveraging open source made a heck of a lot of sense. And so we introduced a downloadable version of our product in August of last year at Linux World in San Francisco. And so we've been out for a little bit over a year. We have over 50,000 downloads in over 80 countries around the world that are taking advantage of our free downloaded Express Edition product. And that's now starting to convert into meaningful business for us, and it's a meaningful part of our revenue stream now today. And so our business model is software as a service. We believe that the next version of software as a service, not the conventional wisdom today perhaps, but where it's going, is that is a subscription-based offering that includes software enhancements, bug fixes, and remote maintenance and support. And our definition, that is a great business model that does not require the server to be living in our data center, that it can live behind the customer's firewall, that we can provide our subscription-based service remotely and connect to technology that's sitting behind the firewall. And in fact, the future is the truth is somewhere in between, something in the cloud, something behind the firewall. And so for us then, having an on-premise version of our product that's also subscription-based makes perfect sense. It's very consistent with where our strategy goes. Ultimately, the core success for software as a service companies is a very extensive try before you buy program. For most software as a service companies, try before you buy means a 30-day trial. In our case, we've decided to dramatically expand the definition of try before you buy, and really in the open source world, it's deploy before you buy. You get to use a free version of the product. It has a substantial amount of capabilities. You can run in our case, you can run a small business or a not very complicated medium-sized business using our free version and never pay us a dollar. And so we have an extensive set of options for customers. They can download it, try it, use it themselves. We have a hosted version of our free Express Edition as well. You can try that. We have trials of our enhanced capabilities as well. Lots of demos on site, videos, all kinds of training, total transparency. And so the model that's emerging, we think, is extensive try before you buy. When you're dealing with the mid-market, the dollar size of the transactions is not very high. And so you have to figure out a way to close customers in a much lower cost of sales and marketing. And the challenge for most software companies here in the audience is how do you reduce sales and marketing expense, because that's the humongous number that doesn't want to ever go down. And so what we're doing is we're re-engineering the front end of the sales funnel, trying to offload as much of the discovery and evaluation process onto the customer, let them do it through a self-service strategy, let them try it, let them work it through, let them see value, and then have them come in and talk to our more expensive salespeople on the phone where we decide to close them. And so, the advantage of our model, which is a hybrid model, software as a service is the business model, two choices, deployment on-premise, on-demand, customer decides, same pricing for both, extensive try before you buy, let the customers evaluate the product, see the advantages of it, and then hopefully compress the amount of time that you have expensive salespeople talking to them, and then close them in that way. Through that whole process, the other thing I'd say is that software as a service, the heart of that is subscription-based, which means that, in our case, customers buy on a per-seat basis 12 months in advance. Every year they renew. And so when you're in a renewal business, it's all about getting the renewal. All the money you spend in year one is acquiring the customer, and you don't make any money in year one. You make money over time by having very high renewal rates. And so to succeed in that business requires the company to be very customer-centric. In our opinion, total transparency. And so transparency comes in terms of try before you buy. Transparency is here's all of our pricing. Transparency is here's our source code. It's available. You can go look at it yourself. It's all out there. And so what you're trying to do is match the customer's expectations with your ability to deliver. And through that process, having a great support, sales and support team behind the scenes, you're able to have high renewal rates. Our company has well over 90% renewal rates today. And you know, we think that transparency and our ability to offer all of this to our customers is a key reason why. So we're a little bit different. We're also an enterprise application and open source. We were the first software as a service hosted company in performance management. There are now two today, 4 years later. We were the first open source performance management company and remain the only one in that category as well. So, you know, enterprise apps and open source is becoming more and more mainstream. We're one of the first companies to see real success as a result of that. You have a question?
Yeah, just a quick question. Do you think you could have accomplished the same thing with free but not open source software?
A great question. Hopefully everybody heard it. Accomplished the same thing with free instead of with open source. Hotly debated issue. There was an earlier version of adaptive planning that tried a little bit of free and nobody paid any attention. The biggest challenge for a company that's starting up is getting awareness, and people have to find you one way or the other. SourceForge, where we distribute our product today, is a global distribution channel that is virtually friction-free and cost us no money. So let me go back through that again. 50,000 downloads, over 80 countries around the world in 12 months. It didn't cost us anything to go there. That was a free distribution channel. Now, we're a company today that's just pushing 50 employees. A year ago, we had 25. How do you end up with a product in 80 countries around the world? I mean, what other distribution channel is that available, that accessible, that free? Okay, and so for us, SourceForge is a key part of our strategy, and the only way you play at SourceForge is with open source. So arguably that alone justifies it. But beyond that, in terms of supporting the transparency aspects, what's more transparent than open source? The last piece I'd say is that a key part of our strategy in our market is to have a great partner channel worldwide and get there sooner than later. And so to get to those countries, to get to those partners, they're finding us, we're not finding them, and they're finding us through open source and going through that segment. So the answer for us is an emphatic yes. Question?
So how much of your code comes from the community versus from your developers?
Yeah, so we're a little bit different. I think if you look at enterprise app companies, the challenge is for the developer community is that you have to have multiple skills. You have to not only be, in our case, good at Java programming, but you have to understand the domain. And so, we sell to finance people. And so understanding what finance people want and how that application works, understanding, you know, business rules and workflows and all of that, isn't for most developers. And so I think it's already more challenging for you to build a developer, traditional one-at-a-time developer community around enterprise applications. I think it's even more challenging when you're talking about finance apps because that's not the most glamorous place for developers to hang out, you know, in their day jobs. We always viewed our developer community as being primarily comprised of partners. And the people who would get this sooner than later would be our partners who wanted to provide value around our core application to go after their target customer or vertical market. And we've seen, you know, the real traction with that. We'll just spend all day today with the partner who's signing up to localize our product and translate it into one of the Asian languages, left to our own devices, that's at least 12 to 18 months away. They're doing it today with their people and are really amazing as with their ability to do a lot of that on their own. So, for us, the developer community today is primarily partners with a couple of customers that are taking the staff at it. It's mostly partners.
But the core code, so it's mostly developed by you, or 100%?
Yes, today virtually all of it's developed by us. And in our decision to go to open source, the community contribution for code, we always viewed as being a nice upside, let's say, in the first couple of years. What we thought we would get a lot sooner was much better customer feedback. We've absolutely seen that. Around the clock, around the world, it comes in from all kinds of places, and they say, you know what? What about this and what about that? So great feedback, and then to a certain extent, the early response on the bug identification—not the fix, but at least identifying the problem, something. So that's been very helpful to us. Any other questions?
Yeah, I'm curious.
Yeah.
Do you have
think there was an
issue. Yes, I was wondering.
It's okay. Yeah. I want to make sure
yeah.
we get...
Sorry, this was just introductory. You must be my 2 minutes. So anyway, why don't we hold the rest of the questions, and then we'll come back around, and otherwise I'm certainly available afterwards to answer your questions. So
We have a slot at the end of this for questions, and she said you'll be hanging around afterwards. So let me ask John to give a brief introduction of ZenSource here.
Yeah, that'd be great. Sure. Okay. So I think I'm going to step over here if you don't mind, just so I can see what we're saying up here. Sorry, Bernard.
I'm John Vera from ZenSource here in Palo Alto. We're the other virtualization company in Palo Alto. And it's very interesting what both Bernard and Bill said today. And so I think I want to start my remarks for those of you that are new to open source or evaluating converting to an open source model, who maybe have done marketing here in the Valley for 5, 10, 15, 20, 50 years, whatever it is, right? So everything you just heard Bernard and Bill describe is pretty revolutionary. You might not see it as that as yet, but let me just contrast what I was doing 3 years ago here in the Valley. I was SVP of marketing at a company called Interwoven, which is a $250 million enterprise software company. We had 200 salespeople, a lot of system engineers. We had 50 inside salespeople. I had 75 marketing people on my team. We spent most of our time cold calling, buying lists, cold calling, doing campaigns, doing live events, seminars, targeting IT execs. Our average selling price was, $250,000. Our sales cycle is 12 to 18 months. So what I would suggest is if you're interested in open source, all that stuff I just told you about, this sort of enterprise sales model, throw it in the dumpster. It's pretty much worthless. I mean, you throw all that crap in the dumpster, and you start over when you come to open source. And here's why. So in the next 5 or 10 minutes, I'll try to share some of the key learnings I had in the last 18 months, some of which were very shocking, coming from, $250 million software company targeting CIOs with $250,000 ASP and, BMW driving salespeople who like to make $1 million a year and so on and so forth, to, really bare-knuckle, grassroots, as both Bernard and Bill described, open source software sales and marketing. It's really a completely different world. But just like when you study a new language, a foreign language, at first you get into it and it kind of blows your mind and you think, I am never going to get through this. I remember being in the basement of the library at Oberlin College writing kanji for hours and hours and hours, and going outside in the snow and saying, what the hell am I doing here? But it just sort of clicks in one day and you get it. And that's sort of what happens with open source. So don't dismay, don't despair. Even though you may have spent 5, 10, 15, or 50 years marketing software here in the Valley, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And I'm a firsthand example of that. So succeeding with open source. I liked Bernard's title of his book. So ZenSource. Next one, please, John. Citrix to acquire ZenSource for $500 million in cash and stock. That was last month. So this was so far the high water mark for open source software. What am I doing wrong here? So far the high water mark for open source software in terms of a sales price. And I'm hoping somebody in this room can beat that, because it seems like a really big number. But I think what you're seeing here is these numbers continue to go up. I think it was JBoss sold to Red Hat last year for $300, $350. Now this $500. I'm going to change mics here if you don't mind.
Let's see here. Try this one. This
comes. How's that? A little better, right?
Way better.
Way better. Okay. So not putting this up to self-promote or congratulate, although it sure does feel good, it's just to show you that you can do it, right? I joined this company 18 months ago. It was in a tank. Bernard came and saw us. He can tell you it wasn't
you know, things weren't that great, but, you know, we did a few things, and I'll try to share that in the next few slides, to try to just put into a little bit of a cookbook for you. It's never the same with your company, your market, your segment, but there are a few best practices I'm hoping I can share with you and make it worth your while coming tonight, in addition to the great words from Bernard and Bill. Next one, please. So, obviously, you know, Citrix saw this as a huge opportunity for them. A very rapidly growing market, server, desktop, application, virtualization. There was a lot of synergy between the two companies, and I think together we're going to go on and do great things, right? I mean, we're a small little company in Palo Alto with 80 employees. They're, I don't know, 6,000 employees, 200,000 customers. They're on like 90 million desktops worldwide, and somehow they've managed to partner with Microsoft for 18 years and not get killed. So we also have a good partnership with Microsoft. So that's all sort of the future. But talking about how we did it, I think, is what matters to you guys. So how do we do it? Something that Bernard talked about that I think is significant, and also Bill, is there aren't a lot of open source companies that come out of nowhere and create a whole new segment. So if you're trying to create a whole new segment and use open source to do it, God bless you. Come talk to me after, and you can share your slide of how you did it with me, because I think it's going to be damn hard. Piling, you know, sort of a risk of a new distribution vehicle on top of the risk of a new market, it can be done, but it's like two difficult things combined, maybe just too much to handle, right? A bridge too far. So what we decided to do, as Bill and his company have done, as the Linux distros did, right? What did they do? They picked a known segment. Operating systems. Right? Operating systems. They said Microsoft, Sun, Solaris, HP UX, IBM AIX. It's too expensive. It's too difficult. There's a better way. That's Linux. Right? Another example. Sugar CRM. Great company. John Roberts is the CEO. Amazing guy. Amazing entrepreneur. Known segment with legs. Bill's segment. A known segment with legs, a growth segment where there's a better way. In our case, we picked virtualization, right, because that was sort of the impetus of the Zen project, which came out of the University of Cambridge. Our founders were computer science professors at Cambridge, and they thought there was a better way to manage distributed virtualized systems, and that was the birth of Zen. The Zen project was really called the Zeno project, which really stands for diversity, Zen, Zeno. And that's how the name came up. Shadow the incumbent. You may want to pick a fight. And I'll talk a little bit about how we had a great set of founders, one of whom became the sort of, you know, teddy bear with the open source community. Bernard talked a lot about the community and nurturing the relations. That's Ian Pratt. The other one who became sort of our bulldog, you know, human missile for the commercial side of the market to really be competitive and pick a fight. What are you really talking about here in open source if you're following a known segment with legs is sort of a David and Goliath story, right? The press likes that. Customers like that. Channel partners like that. They're tired of being beaten up by a large, dominant player. They might want to listen to somebody new who's going to come along and show them a better, faster, cheaper way. Create drag. Linux vendors, we got Zen adopted by both Red Hat in the Red Hat Enterprise Linux 5 and Novell in the SUSE distributions. Also, Intel and AMD, huge sense of rivalry there. They're beating the hell out of each other and leapfrogging each other. If you can get yourself in the middle of something like that, where a couple of vendors have a high sense of rivalry and you can show value to both sides, you'll do well. Who knows what that means? E-M-O-M-E-I-M-F. Anybody? That's a John Vera special. All my former employees know what that means. As soon as I write that on the board, they go, enemy of my enemy is my friend. Right? So, enemy of my enemy is my friend. Well, 18 months ago when Bernard first came to see us, it was sort of like VMware and Microsoft and ZenSource were the three leaders. Well, what did we do? We worked a collaborative development agreement, a strategic partnership with Microsoft. We both decided that maybe together is a better way to approach competing with VMware. It's kind of funny to think about Microsoft as a minority player in a market, but in this segment, VMware has 95% market share, 95% of a you know, multi-billion dollar market that's growing, what percent a year, Bernard?
Huge.
100% a year growth. Unbelievable. Doesn't go on forever, but it's great right now. So seed. I liked what Bill was saying there. Look at open source as a vehicle. That's your lead generation vehicle. Not seminars, not trade shows, not buying lists, not cold calling. Forget all that. Throw that crap in the dumpster. Think about having a great product that's innovative and distributing it over the web through your community and making your community extremely active. The Zen community includes regular contribution from about 300 engineers. How many employees did I say we have? 80. Yeah, 65 of them are engineers, but what about the rest? The other engineers come from Intel, AMD, HP, IBM, so on and so forth, Red Hat, Novell. How can a company with 80 employees and some nice venture capital build a competitive threat to VMware? One way to do it, as Bernard Bill said, is through open source. You're sharing the gain by getting developers to contribute from other companies. It's amazing. And guess what? As soon as their products ship, your product may just be optimized and run faster than the competitor's products when Intel ships a new chip, or AMD, or HP ships a new server, so on and so forth. So it's aligning your goals like that. Innovate fast, quarterly releases. We just kept going. Boom, 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 boom. Our competitor does pretty much annual releases. And so you have an ability to move faster than the incumbent because you are moving with open source. This is when you get into more of the marketing stuff. Brand, PR, website, Google, wiring holes. Okay. Make sure that you have a branding strategy. Make sure you own your trademarks. Because, you know, Bernard and Bill both talked about the collaborative nature of open source. The flip side of that is it's Wild West. And it's very chaotic, and there's a lot of pushing and pulling. And if you don't own your marks, and you don't assert yourself that this is our project and we own this brand, you can get hijacked very easily. We had an example where a competitor called Virtual Iron out in Boston tried to hijack our brand and did not use our code at all and started telling all the press and analysts that they were actually the leaders of the Zen project and that they were a Zen-based initiative. Well, fortunately, we owned the registered trademark, and we had a good trademark attorney, and we basically shut them down. They'd take it off their website, but it was ugly for a while. And now they still sort of whisper that they're Zen, but we basically left them in the dust because they couldn't steal our brand. So make sure you own your marks.
Which company was that?
Virtual Iron.
When did they do that?
About a year ago, April of 2006.
They're a former client of mine, so I'm kind of surprised they pulled that.
Well, you know, I mean, it happens, right? So the PR, get a great PR firm. This is a marketing stick, right? Go for somebody who is going to be able to get you great exposure in PR, and go to the influencers who are not just the writers. You know, go to the experts like Bernard, right? I mean, he's someone who is a writer that you know, has a lot of great coverage. A lot of the bloggers out there, you know, people in our segment, it's like Dan Kuznetsky, who used to be with IDC, he's with ZDNet. Charlie Babcock, Information Week, you know, Stephen Shanklin, CNET. I mean, these are sort of the go-to people, you know, the people at CRN. And just really work those relationships. I can tell you afterwards who our firm was. The website should be stellar, and it should look bigger than you are, right? It's your lifeblood. Invest in it. Don't scrimp on it. Make it look great. Make it easy. And make it so people can get the product from your website right up front. You've seeded it through open source. Now, what's your business model? I didn't put up here, but you should know what your business model is. Don't just go blindly in and say, we're open source. And then 6 months later, you burned all your cash, and you said, how are we going to make money again? So, no, are you like a Red Hat? Are you going to make money on service and support? Or are you more like a Zen Source, where we sell proprietary licenses built on top of the open source Zen model? Or are you something else that you invent? So know what your business model is. Up front, and I can't say enough good things about Google in terms of marketeers' great ROI. I mean, those things I talked about before used to cost me $50 to get somebody to show up at a seminar, and then an 18-month sales cycle. With Google, I can get somebody to my site for $1, $2, and then I just have to convert them. through putting some breadcrumbs along the way. I'm big on email forms and sending out newsletters. Probably taking up too much time here, but watering holes, it just means, I had a former employee who taught me that concept. Where do these people hang out? You know, where is your target market hang out? Is it something like the SIG? Is it a developer forum? What are the conferences and where do they hang out? Creating an ecosystem is big. Upsell, upsell, wash, rinse, repeat. I mean, it's get it out there. Bill talked about seeding through open source, but then what? How do you convert them? In our case, what we did is we kept a drumbeat going about our company, and I actually talked to both MySQL and JBoss, and I talked to the people who are in charge of their revenue and their campaigns. And I did a lot of benchmarking. I would encourage you guys to do that. And what both those companies told me was they kept a steady stream of communications going to those prospects. They gave a very valuable experience to those prospects. Bill talked about, I think you said, 50,000 downloads. He may never see some of those people, but he doesn't care. What he decided was to give a very functional product. We did the same thing. We've gotten, you know, some huge number of downloads as well, and now those people are just coming back. And they're just buying the product every day, every week. So it's a completely different model. It's more about harvesting than cold calling. And that's what I would say about open source. The last slide, if you could put it up, John, is just sort of this role thing that we have between our two co-founders, both computer science faculty members at University of Cambridge. The guy on the left is the teddy bear, Mr. Nice Guy, right? So we kind of did a little good cop, bad cop. He nurtured the community and still does today and will going forward. The guy on the right, Simon, is more the lightning rod, right? Someone who sort of picks the fight with VMware, stirs controversy, keeps the brand going, keeps some focus on you as a company. It worked really well. I don't even think we thought about it going in, but when Bernard asked me to write a few slides about this, it sort of struck me that you might want to think about this type of model, because if you just have a founder who's working with the open source community and you don't have kind of a bulldog to assert the company, you may have problems. So how does the founder keep all the feelings of all the constituencies considered? How does he keep them all calm? How does he keep them all happy if he's slapping them around all the time? And so you might want to think about how you have different roles to manage the community. Someone who's the person that keeps things going, the project leader, or maybe someone else who's taking a more controversial stance for your company. That's all I have to say, and I'm around for questions at the end. Sorry I took so much time, but I thought it was kind of a fresh case study since we just sold the company, and I just lived through this for the last year and a half. Thanks very much.
We'll get back to you. Thank you. I want to cover a couple points before we open it up. I wanted to go through some of the marketing issues, which have already been covered in a number of ways, but a couple points I wanted to drill down on, as well as development and alliances. So let me ask you, Bill, can you hear me, by the way? Okay?
Yeah.
So I'm hearing a lot
about... your microphone on.
I'm sorry?
I don't think your microphone's on.
Turn it on?
Okay. Thanks. So I'm hearing a lot of executing on viral type marketing and Google and the internet and so forth. What I want to ask you is, and anybody else who wants to chime in, since you've had you're in the 99th percentile in SourceForge, what is it about open source that allows you to do that as opposed to just normal? You know, viral internet, Google, et cetera, marketing that you could do with any kind of software?
Let me go back a step, because I said before all of you take all of your marketing collateral and programs and throw it in the dumpster. that may work for certain companies. Some of us were, you know, it's more of a transition. And so I will say that if you look at our, we have a very integrated marketing program. And as I said earlier, the core of this is Test Drive, but we have a very extensive lead generation activities. We are still buying lists. We are building a very extensive in-house database. We have very targeted email campaigns. We do some seminars with some of our partners. We do still show up at certain trade shows. And so some of the traditional programs actually are still quite useful in our market because, you know, our core product, and we came from again, was software as a service, the on-demand version. And so, you know, when you're selling to people in finance, you have to go to where they are and try to figure them out. So we are, you know, for us, the evolution to they find us, it's all viral. And, you know, we keep them, help keep them warm until they're ready to buy and then learn, upgrade them up to the chargeable versions. That is much, very much of a work in progress. And so we still have to do some of the other programs, but we continue to tweak that every quarter. You know, in that context for us, as I said, SourceForge is a great global distribution channel. It's a lot of free awareness effectively for us. And so for people who go to that place to discover new opportunities for, you know, new solutions, they're going to go in and they're going to put in some keyword and they're going to search on it or they're going to use the software map that's there to drill down and find things. And so in that context, your ranking at SourceForge for that channel matters. Much like, you know, there's a Google search optimization, there are, you know, there are things that you would do to try to improve your ranking at SourceForge because it makes it easier for people to discover you. And you don't know who they are yet. They haven't registered at your website necessarily, but the first part of the process is getting them to find you. And so a very high percentage of our traffic that comes through is organically created through SourceForge. The formula for SourceForge ranking is all published by them, unlike what Google does. So it's pretty transparent in terms of all the different components that are required to get to drive ranking. But I think it's clear to us that, you know, release early and release often is a key component that drives ranking and drives higher percentile, which increases your visibility, which increases your viral, run rate, if you will, in terms of what comes out of that particular channel.
Relatedly, what is your attach rate from the people you get out of SourceForge to paying customers?
Well, you know, it's interesting, again, is because we came from the hosted world, you know, we keep score perhaps in a little different way than everybody else does. I mean, for us, you know, what we're interested in is paying customers. We're less interested in what flavor they are. And so what we're finding is, you know, if you go back, sort of conventional wisdom would be someone would download a SourceForge, they would install it, they would deploy it, they would start to use it, and at some point they'd say, wow, I want to take advantage of your enhanced capability. I'll buy your upgrade version, install it on site, and I'll manage it myself. That's sort of open source 101. And for a lot of companies, I mean, that's what they do. In particular, I think if you're down at the infrastructure level, that makes perfect sense because it's much more of an IT sale. Now, in our case, remember, we're selling finance. And finance, CFO, controller, VP of planning, those are the people that are signing off on these deals. And so for them, the IT organization is a supporting cast member in most cases. That's all it is. So what we're finding is that, yes, some of our customers are downloading, deploying, and upgrading and staying on-premise. But other customers, this is a sales tool. So the ability to download it, to discover it, download it, to start looking at it, to start using it, it's a sales tool. And then when they identify themselves to us through the different schemes that we have to get them to identify themselves, they say, well, what else do you have? You've got a hosted version. Oh, how interesting. That sounds a lot easier, actually. I don't need to do it myself. Is that right? Right. And so we're converting downloading customers with the sales tool being download into paying hosted customers who don't even care at that point about open source anymore. What they care about is solving a business problem. And so you know, our whole approach on this is to give customers lots of different ways to discover the value, offer, we're totally agnostic in terms of how they deploy it. Our pricing is the same. Our salespeople are comp the same regardless of how they use it. But just get them in the door, get them playing with it, and then find the right solution that meets their problem. And so conversion rate then for us, I mean, what is the conversion rate when someone uses the first way they discover you is through the sales tool called the download of SourceForge, where they buy your hosted version. You give credit to open source for that? Well, we call it an assist. Right? And that's what you have. Because for us, it's an integrated sales and marketing program. We're not religious. We don't describe ourselves as, quote, a commercial open source company. You ask who we are, we're a SaaS company. We offer two choices of deployment. And we happen to be extremely open. But that doesn't make us something else. Yes, sir?
Most of the finance people I know don't go on
Yes, they don't go to SourceForge, you think, right?
Okay.
Yes.
So just the question is the education piece of educating the customer.
Yeah, well, what's very interesting is, this is the old world and the new world. it's changing like lightning fast here. Conventional wisdom, I think, is, you know, Linux, the Linux crowd hangs out at SourceForge, et cetera, et cetera. And what's interesting to us is, in now 13 months of experience, a surprisingly high percentage of the people who come through SourceForge have business titles, or finance titles. And so the little sleeper story out there is a lot of business people are hanging around SourceForge. Well, what's that all about? Well, you can download our product and have it installed in an hour. Okay? Push one button, click, and you've got to go down and install. And you can open it up and you can start working with it and building your budgeting and planning application in our app. You know, you can go a long way these days without having a bunch of IT people. And so we, and Kumar was here from our team, we saw one of the titles was a CFO from the Midwest, and so we called the lady up, you know, what the heck are you doing? And she said, where are you now? Oh, you're in Silicon Valley. Well, you guys out there, you have tons of IT people, I'm sure, in your company. I had actually one IT person in this. And she said, well, we don't have those kind of resources. We're in the Midwest. And out here, we do things ourselves. We have to take care of ourselves. So I'm a CFO. I downloaded it myself. I deployed it myself, and I'm using it. And so the future, see, this is for me is, you know, web access 1995, for those of you who are old enough to remember that, you know, you had to go hack it together. You bought your kit down at Kepler's. You know, I had a Mac system, which was a colossal mistake in 1995 for getting web access because there wasn't any network support except for Wombat here. And so you go through this, and it takes you forever to get the thing up and running, right? Well, that was 1995. Well, today, it's just there. What if SourceForge in the download world of open source applications is 1995? Where will we be in 2 and 3 and 4 years? How much easier is it getting? We're creating friction-free packaged solutions that download and install like that. Why do you need a bunch of IT people to help you out? That distribution channel is a channel not just for IT people, but for business people around the world. And hello, it's free.
Like in all the open source projects that we've seen, downloads is a good metric, and even ZenSource is a success story. But if you think about an independent company who wants to sustain on its own revenue stream, mm-hmm. I would not believe that even ZenSource could have survived. It is a strategic acquisition. And not in, you know, like other exit. My question is, I would guess, like based on my own experience, probably your revenue stream is less than $2 million. Maybe I'm right or wrong, but the question is, how do you grow your company on a revenue basis? Not like how many downloads this VC is funded, that's fine. Right. When you can go and say, heck with you VC, I'm on my own, I'm going to be the next Microsoft
right.
in real revenues.
Right.
Not in terms of, you know.
Well, so you need, so I mean, the answer in our case is, I mean, we do the math, to be a relevant company, you need, you know, I mean, NetSuite's going public with a little over 5,000 customers, and they're in the same market size as, you know, a little bit under ours, and so we'll use that to say, okay, there's an IPO strategy with 5,000 customers. Okay, so how do you get 5,000 customers? In our case, it's subscription-based relationships over time, right? We don't care how we get them.
That's good.
Right? And so for us, you know, to us, open source is not a business model. It is a set of techniques that different people use in different ways. As Bernard had on the slides, there's like a half a dozen different reasons why you might have an open source strategy. It's a set of techniques. One of the interesting techniques that we leverage is the distribution channel called SourceForge. Another technique is how to build a partner channel, you know, lightning fast globally, because they find you and they can provide value easily, you know, around that model. So those are two of the six things that are on his list that we like. Other people say it's all about developer community. That was less important. But it's a piece of our puzzle. It's not the only thing that we do.
Well, speaking of developer community, I wanted to ask John to address a little bit how you've worked with developers, moving away a little bit from the marketing focus on this to what is the development model. I don't know if it's your quote or someone in ZenSource, but that you work with other companies in developing what they refer to as the engine, and you put the car together. And so you have a group of companies, tell me if I got this wrong, that are working on the same kind of engine product, and then they all go out and they put the car around it and sell different models, a Ferrari and the General Motor, whatever, and compete with each other. As a development model per se, can you address a little bit how that works?
Sure.
So
you could, if you could find the on switch.
If I find the on switch, it'd be dangerous. So, in our case, clearly the biggest benefit of being an open source company is not the distribution and the downloads. it's the innovation. And so, you know, again, for a small company, 80 employees, to have top engineers from Intel, AMD, IBM, HP, Red Hat, et cetera, pounding away on this thing and adding new instructions literally daily, and then exposing that code to the world and the community, running open tests and whatnot, is extremely valuable. So that's what John alluded to in terms of the Zen engine. Then any company, since this is Zen engine is open source, can take that virtualization engine and build it into their own solution. So two examples I cited previously were Red Hat and Novell for SUSE. What's a little bit unique on us is we then take the open source engine and put some proprietary bits on there, especially around Windows. Because in the case of Windows, Microsoft won't touch GPL. So when we did this agreement with Microsoft, we basically had to re-implement Zen in a clean room environment up in Redmond and put some proprietary wrappers around it so that it could work together with Windows. So we're sort of selling these engines of Zen. We're also selling, you know, complete vehicles, as are people like Red Hat. It's a little bit complicated to explain. Back to the gentleman's point earlier about customers. We've got almost 1,000 commercial customers, and we started shipping in January. So that's a pretty healthy rate for 1 year of shipments. I do agree that the downloads are sort of like wind direction. They're an indicator, but they aren't the thing that really you should look at. I mean, it's kind of like in the dot-com bubble, right? Everyone wanted eyeballs. They wanted page views and whatnot, but it really didn't matter to revenue. You could have everybody looking at your website all day long to see something, but they might not have been buying anything, right? So what really is the true indicator is revenue. Right, and customer count and repeat buys. So I do agree with that. And I think you'll see a variety of exit paths for open source companies. In some case, it may be sell. In other case, it may be merge. And I also see a path to IPO for extremely successful companies. We were looking at that as plan A or plan B, and the other was to come together with somebody like Citrix. I mean, if we basically had continued our current course and speed, we would have probably done 20 to 30 million next year in revenue, and we'd have been profitable, and we'd have been on sort of the doorstep of an IPO, right? So those are the choices you look at. But I do agree, it's not the downloads. Those are just an indicator. It's the customer count, the repeat buys, and the reference customers, average selling price, size of a deal. What's VMware's average deal size? Who knows?
About 5,000.
It's a little low. It's actually $23,000. And they've got a $20 billion market cap. So not bad for $23,000 a sale. You make a hell of a lot of $23,000 sales.
In developing that engine, what's the difference between proprietary companies forming either joint development alliances or forming joint ventures or any form of proprietary alliance?
Great question. So it's probably the level of help we ZenSource would give those companies. If a company wants to take the open source Zen GPL engine, they take it. We help them. You know, we do assist Red Hat and Novell to some extent to birth their products. But if a company were to do a commercial agreement with us on our OEM products, they would get a lot more specific R&D. An example would be Symantec. We did an OEM agreement with Symantec, and our products are being fused together, and there's dedicated engineering for that. Last week we announced an OEM edition targeting the big server vendors, so you see some announcements there where we'll be coming out with the Zen commercial product embedded in some of the major server offerings from the big x86 folks. In that case, they'd probably get a little bit more of a dedicated team as opposed to the typical community, work on the mailing list and whatnot. That, again, is a decision you have to make. If you're kind of a hybrid company like ZenSource, you have to sooner or later draw a line in terms of how much resource you put on the open source community, where it's essential and it's driving your innovation, but you might not be getting paid, versus, I've got somebody like Symantec or Microsoft or Dell, HP, IBM, where they want to do an OEM agreement and, you know, financial considerations are exchanged, where do you put your engineers? I think there's a balance point between those two, and you may face that as a company.
Okay. I want to get to the your questions, but I have one more area I've got to cover, and that's third parties and alliances and acquisitions. So, and Bernard, feel free to jump in at any point. Talk to us about Citrix. How did you do it? And is there something about being an open source company that makes it more challenging or makes it more advantageous?
No, I think it's a bit of a misnomer that open source companies and proprietary companies can't work together, because I think the acquisition of ZenSource by Citrix is another signal, as Bernard said in his opening remarks with the Dilbert cartoon, that open source is mainstream, right? I mean, somehow that company figured out that, you know, acquiring a company that has open source roots and an open source engine was fine. You know, from an IP standpoint, from a valuation standpoint, from a channel standpoint, from a community relations standpoint, they went through all that. So how did it happen? Well, the person who introduced me to the company is a guy called Kevin Compton, who's a partner of Kleiner Perkins. Great guy. I've known him for years. And he's a long time, I think he's a former board member at Citrix. So there was a relationship there. That helped. You know, Mark Templeton, the CEO of Citrix, is, if you haven't met him, he's an incredibly dynamic person, very hands-on. So he came over to visit us a little over a year ago as a partner. Right, just to spend, yeah, like extra hour to kill here in Silicon Valley. He ended up staying, you know, half a day and spending time with Simon Crosby, our CTO, and myself. And he really jumped in right away, and he got it. Then we didn't hear anything, and the whole tone of that discussion had nothing to do with an acquisition. It was more like, tell me about virtualization, tell me about Zen. And that's how all these conversations start. I think if you go into any of these relationships and saying, what will you pay for my company? That's sort of a showstopper right up front. I mean, I think 20 years in this valley show me grow your business, success will follow. So I think you as entrepreneurs, those of you that have, you know, designs on starting open source companies, should think about what can I do to help my customers solve problems, to provide value to my customers, my partners, and everything else will follow. Don't worry about the price for your company and all that stuff. Worry about delivering value for your customers, your partners, and good things will happen. So that's sort of what happened in this case. I mean, all those conversations go like that.
Nevertheless, the price was a hell of a price. So one of the questions is, right place at the right time, or is there something about the viral effect of being open source that gave that a force multiplier effect?
Probably a little both. So I do a lot of work with the Wall Street types, and because, you know, VMware had a pretty extensive quiet period, so they couldn't really talk. So all the analysts were calling people like Virgil Iron, Mike Grandinetti, and I were going to Wall Street doing all these panels because all the investors wanted to know, what is this virtualization stuff, and why is Goldman Sachs trying to get me to pay this outrageous multiple for VMware or whatever. So I spent a lot of time there, and if you just look at the multiple that VMware garnered and continues to garner, relative to our revenue and our install base that was growing so rapidly, $500 million is actually a fair price. Seems a little bit crazy, but it is. Any way you cut it, they're getting into a rocket growth market. Right? I mean, don't you think that if there were a real viable alternative to Google, say 4 years ago, don't you think Microsoft probably should have bought that company and paid pretty dearly? Because how many billions have they sunk to try to take Google out and failed? I think Citrix has sort of said, hey, we like this market. It's extremely adjacent to our market, and we're going to go after it. So the whole strategy, combined strategy of Citrix and ZenSource, is about rolling up virtualization across the entire application platform. Server, ZenSource. Storage, Symantec, who happens to be an enemy of EMC. Desktop, Citrix, application Citrix. And we just happened to all get along with Microsoft, and VMware says the operating system's dead, so there's some friction there.
So Bernard, unless Bernard or Bill has some more comments, Brian.
I just want to say one thing around alliances, which is for open source companies, I think alliances take on us more importance than if the proprietary alternative. And that's because a lot of with open source is getting known, getting awareness, because you don't have a lot of the tools you usually have had in the past, where you basically are just hiring a lot of marketing and salespeople. Absent that, how do you get known? And one of the ways you get known is to make friends in the open source world with other open source companies, and you know, start either integrating with them or something as a way of getting people who are those companies' users aware of yours. And so alliances take on, I think, a more significant role with open source, and it's something to be aware of and pay attention to.
Thank you. I know there are a lot of questions out there, so let's dive into some Q&A. Please. Yes.
I have a question for Bill. I was wondering, why do you have the same price for your hosted version and your on-premises version?
Should we repeat the question?
You might have more cost with the hosted version, but more locked in with the...
Right. So the question was, why do we have the same price for our on-premise version as for our hosted version? We would think the hosted version would be more expensive because we have more cost. What's interesting is that we looked at the cost structure for both sides, and... you know, the multi-tenant infrastructure that we have in our data center, the incremental cost to add the next customer isn't anywhere near what we think it is. And so the incremental hosting cost, not so bad. On the other hand, you know, technology living out in the wild behind the firewall, you probably have more, you have potentially more technical support questions in terms of interoperability and so forth. And we looked at it and we said, you know, it could go one way, it could go the other way. You know, the most important thing is keep it simple. One price, done. And that's been great because, you know, customers don't agonize over why we decided one was priced more than the other. It's just one less thing to worry about, and we're into short sales cycles, so just eliminating complexity.
Jim?
And I'll pose this, just throw it over to the panel, whoever would like to respond. One of the issues I have heard historically a lot, I was talking about some of the BEA solutions that supported open source in one fashion or another. They have a strategy called blended, bringing together proprietary open source. That's one issue. But one reaction I would get pretty commonly was, love to use open source, but our legal department won't let us. They're deathly afraid of someone popping up out of the woodwork and suing us. How do you address that kind of a concern? It's not a unique one. I've heard it more than once.
Well, while they're thinking, I'll just jump in. I think what's interesting is, you know, we're under the GPL 2 at this point. At some point, probably we'll move to GPL 3 when, you know, things kind of stabilize out there. You know, the opportunity with upselling customers is to not only sell them enhanced capabilities, but also indemnification. And so it may support your conversion process by making that available. So if someone has a concern about that, then great, you know, buy our commercial edition and you know, sign those agreements and get protected, and you know, we'll take that responsibility.
Okay.
So, I mean, I think it's a legitimate issue for a lot of customers. You know, they kind of come through all this and make their own decisions. But, you know, JBoss was very successful in targeting wealthy corporate Fortune 500 companies with deep pockets and saying, you know, buy an insurance policy, you know, from us with the support and indemnification. That's where a lot of their money came from, was through that.
Yeah. What I would add, a couple of things. First of all, that's a way that your license can align with your business strategy to provide you with a value proposition that people want to give you money for an open source product. So that's one thing, is just there's a nice word that there's alignment. And there are open source companies that essentially have that. You know, it's kind of a, you know, maybe it's the wrong way to say it, but they have, you know, GPL is kind of a time bomb, and they'll go sell you, you know, the diffusing mechanism if you give them some money. So that's one thing. The other thing I'd say about corporate attorneys kind of saying, geez, I'm not comfortable with that, I don't want that. That makes a ton of sense for an environment where they're aware of it up front.
And that's the traditional procurement model. You know, we're interested in buying a product, we're going to put together an RFP, people are interested. You know, they get alerted to an acquisition, to a procurement, what I'm talking about, procurement acquisition. Open source in a lot of companies never goes that route. It gets downloaded by somebody off in the corner. And what happens is it eventually comes to the attorney as a, oh, by the way, did you know we have blah, 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 blah. Then they go, oh, my God. And I, frankly, I work with a lot of end users that kind of start to say, we better get more of a policy and a praxis and a process around this because it's already there. And so in a way, the attorney saying, oh, no, you can't do that is, in the classic sense, is kind of somebody locking the barn door after the horse is bolted because the software is in there. And I'm sure, I'm absolutely certain that both these companies have achieved customers who somebody downloaded it, started using it, loved it. Hey, this is great. Look what we're doing. Oh, my God. What is this about this license? We better call them up and get you know, protection.
Next. As an extension to what he asked regarding licensing, you know, you have to figure out what licenses of the components are you using. What if I build an open source product and also a commercial version as you know you guys have, and I'm using certain open source components which are in a given license, you know, area, but the license changes. Is that possible? The person who is supplying that open source components under an Apache license, which is much more commercial vendor friendly, makes it GPL. Then I have to GPL everything I've done in the commercial space as well. Is that right? Or you know, once you have taken certain components, they become your IP under the license you took them.
Can you summarize the question?
Well, I think the question is sort of, you know, if you utilize open source components in your product, can their licenses impact what happens to your product? And the answer is absolutely. And you know, that's very much in line with what I'm saying is that your product and your strategy has to be aligned with that license and make sense with it. And if you have the wrong licenses in the components that you bring in, you know, that can be at a real you can end up with a real conflict between what your license, what the license require you to do and what you want to do in your business. So it's very important to examine those licenses and understand them.
But can the license change? Like, I mean, if you use a component, can the vendor of that open source component change its license? Like, I'm not open sourcing that anymore. Is that possible? Like,
The question is, can someone who has a product released under an open source license then decide, yeah, I'm going to change the license? And the answer to that is, if they hold the copyright, if they hold the rights to that product, absolutely. But they can't change what the license that the stuff went out in before. They can't retroactively change the license. They can't say, you know, otherwise everybody would do that, right? Here, you know, Oracle would say, here's GPL. Everybody download it, and they come around and say, well, by the way, we changed our minds. You know, where shall I send the invoice? I mean, so you can't retroactively change the license, but you can sort of prospectively change the license. In other words, from now on, it's going to be under this license. And you absolutely can do that, and it's your right to do that. What I would say is that my recommendation would be to think that through very carefully, because it may seem like, oh, now I'm going to start harvesting, but you're also going to find your community all of a sudden is going to be a lot less enthusiastic. And they will either go find a different product to use, or they will take that open source product that you had, fork it, and go off in their own direction. And all of a sudden, you know, it's kind of like you took your ball home, but, you know, you picked up your ball, said, I'm going to go play somewhere else. They said, great, well, we'll just play our own game. So I think that's something you have to look at very carefully before one sort of says, I'm going to, you know, mess around with the license.
We have time for two more questions. Back there.
So I'm starting a company, an open source company, because it aligns very, very much with what we're trying to do. And I'd like to see, you know, what are the top two things that, you know, that you would recommend in starting a business based on some open source?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I'd say, you know, make sure it's a product and a business strategy that makes sense to ride open source. So in other words, you know, both these products are ones that can align very well with open source, particularly ZenSource. I mean, it's perfect for open source. If you had a different kind of a product, it might not align very well. So first off, you know, given all the realities of open source, right? I'm going to look for a community. I'm going to look for downloads. I'm going to be willing to be more transparent. Does that make sense for the product and strategy I'm going to do? And if it does, that's great. And if it doesn't, then you need to think about something different. And really, the second, you know, thing I would really say is, you know, get your license right. Make sure you've got the right license underneath the product or products you're using. And that would also be the case if you're incorporating other open source products or components into yours. I mean, one of the things that's very challenging for companies is, you know, what if you bring in 8 different components and they all have 8 different licenses? You've got 8 different licenses you have to comply with in terms of management. And even if there's not issues around so-called GPL viral stuff that you have to worry about, you still have 8 different sorts of sets of conditions that you've got to make sure that you adhere to. And some of them are like, you know, you have to mention the product in your marketing and in your documentation. And others are you have to put stuff into your into the headers of your files and all that. You've got to make sure you adhere to all those, both from a, I call legal, but from an ethical perspective as well. You don't want to have a product out there that then somebody in the community says, you know, you're not really doing right by that product you're using. So those are the two things.
Yeah, I think just adding to that, I guess if the assumption is that you're a for-profit company, then understanding how you think you're going to try to make money downstream, what that business model looks like, is, I think, pretty important. I mean, the other approach is just put it out there and see what happens and then figure it out from there. And there certainly are a number of examples of where they, you know, they just kind of stumbled upon the right answer. But more likely, you know, you have to find it, what Bernard says. I mean, if you're going to be an open source, more often than not, you need to be in a big space that already exists where there's big, you know, well-known competitors that are already defined the space and you can come in and hack into that. You don't want to be out there creating a brand new market space, right? But having said that, then how are you going to compete against them and where are you going to make money over time? It comes right back down to the basics because, you know, a number of commercial open source companies believe that their revenue stream is going to be support only. And for many years they said, oh, we're not going to charge for enhancements. There's one software baseline and everybody gets it and we'll make our money in support. You can imagine doing that if you were an infrastructure play where you have hundreds of thousands, ultimately millions of downloads and people trying your product and there's just thousands of developers. I mean, it's, you know, so MySQL started that way, right? JBoss certainly was in that realm. But if you're in something that's a little bit smaller, the numbers don't add up. There aren't enough of them out there to just only do it on support. And so you have to think about, okay, I'm going to make my money by, I'm a software company, I'm going to sell my IP. I'm going to have enhancements, which is our strategy. You know, you upgrade for the enhancements that are not part of the baseline product. You have to know that, because that then determines how you position your product, your versions of your product, what goes where, you know, and sort of, you know, what kinds of people you have on your team.
I want to add to the remarks. Do it for the right reasons. Don't do it because it's a trend, a fad, or a gimmick, right? So do it because you believe it's the best way to take software to market and get innovation into your product line. You have to walk this balance between providing value and leading your community and being, I don't want to say punitive, but, you know, sometimes you got to pull out the stick and lead, right? So you can't go too far one way or the other. Let's say you just do everything nice for everybody and you're Mr. Nice Guy. You could get your pocket picked. You know, somebody could come in who's evil and just push you out of the way and take control of your project and fork it, as Bernard said. On the other hand, if you're just out there trying to make money and self-interest is all that matters, the developers in the open source community are going to kick you to the curb on day one. You have to be, the culture that I think Bernard was sort of describing is, it is extremely collaborative. And there's some benevolence that goes on. There's some sharing. I mean, you know, HP and IBM work together. Intel and AMD. I mean, that's the kind of thing that happens here. And so you have to be able to nurture innovation in a collaborative environment across competition. And when the time is right, you got to step up and lead. And you got to pull onto the reins. You know what I mean? Because there will be people who say, hey, look what that company's doing. Our business model's failing. I'm going to go take that project over. It happens all the time, right? And you wish it didn't, but it's sort of the other side of open source. It's easy for anyone to participate, so they do. For good, for bad, or whatever.
Just on raising venture funds, because many people around here, angels are not typically, you don't really understand what we're talking about. VCs understand a little bit more, there's a few out there, but you know, they really sometimes they don't get.
Sure, so I'll give you six names right now, okay? Kevin Compton, Kleiner Perkins, he's also got his own fund called Radar. Pete Sunsini, these are our board members. Pete Sunsini, NEA. Kevin Efrusi, XL. Nick Sturiali, Seven Rosen. And the last one, there's two more. John Connors at Ignition Partners in Seattle, he's a former CFO of Microsoft. Those are our current board members. We did have Peter Fenton. He was at Accel. He is now at Benchmark. He's also outstanding, Peter Fenton. And all these guys understand open source. Clearly they do. So if you're finding some VCs who don't understand open source or don't believe in the model, don't waste your time. Because I just gave you six who do.
Yeah, I think the challenge these days is that in some cases their dance card's pretty well filled. You know, they've invested in a lot of open source companies. And so you have to have something that's going to be quite unique and compelling, because they already checked a lot of the boxes in terms of covering the main categories. And so there's, you know, a lot of stuff's already been ticked off.
I see other questions out there. I think people will stay up here a little bit, and so come on up and ask your questions. Thank you all. It was a great discussion, and I'll turn the floor back over to Ed.